It's episode 197 of the Security Weekly News. Welcome to the week of 20 March 2022. We've got modern problems, Conti, Toyota, Android and more Android, Bitby, HP, and Jason Wood on this edition of the Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Monitoring and maintaining compliance is a never-ending struggle with a high price of failure. FireMon helps customers meet complex and varying compliance requirements. FireMon has fully customizable reporting, analytics, assessments, and dashboards to meet the compliance needs of any organization. With FireMon, compliance reports take a tenth of the time, and real-time continuous compliance eliminates the anxiety and headaches of audit preparation. Improve security outcomes by improving security operations with FireMon. Visit securityweekly.com/FireMon to learn more. Cybercriminals are working overtime. Last year in the fourth quarter alone, phishing attacks disguised as COVID testing information increased by 521%. Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats and how cybercriminals use them to steal money from your company or personal information from your employees and customers. Find out about the 13 email threat types and how Barracuda can provide complete email protection for your teams, your customers, and your reputation. Get your free ebook at securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda.
All right, I'm Doug White, and I did want to start off by shouting out to everybody about our friend and sometimes host, Aaron, who's all around freedom fighting mofo, macho man, Leyland. If you didn't know already, Aaron packed up his kit and sailed into the sunset to help the Ukraine. Well, actually, he flew there, but it didn't sound as good, but I guess I just ruined it. But Aaron is on the ground, literally, whipping shopkeepers and accountants and other IT consultants into a fighting order. I'm not even kidding. I mean, it was like, if you watch this video, I'm not actually kidding for once. So, and if anybody can settle this thing, it's probably Aaron. So cheers, mate. Keep up the good fight. We're all proud of you, and you're doing something that most of us aren't brave enough to do. So, wow. Thanks. In the ongoing conflict between the Ukraine and Russia, well, the Conti gang continues to struggle with their own civil war triggered by that other war. After Conti released a statement supporting the Russian invasion of the Ukraine back in February, Ukrainian security researcher with a handle Conti Leaks began doxing the gang on Twitter. So apparently that person is in the gang, but they just happen to be Ukrainian. So that doesn't usually work out so well. But anyway, yesterday, we reported on this story before, but yesterday, ContiLeaks released more source code. This time, the source code was for Conti ransomware version 3.0, and it was released to VirusTotal. The release includes a locker decryptor and a password-protected archive, and apparently the password is not designed to be... I don't even know why there's a password there. Maybe they had to put it in, but they say, apparently all the comments were implying it was really easy to guess what the password was, I guess. Bleepy Computer took it, compiled it, and said that it did compile without issue, created the executable for both the encryption and decryption file. But Payload Magazine, which is a Polish hacking magazine, said that the new code was a giant step backwards from version 2 of Conti, and that it looked like it might have been written by a third party. And they recommended sticking with the original version 2. I mean, I guess you know you have it made when there's reviews of your malware being provided, you know, by like, magazine, you know, Hack It All magazine gave it 0100 stars. And Mr. Frisky said, I couldn't live without it. Being able to take down my boss really made my day. So, you know, I mean, it's like a brave new world of ransomware. Well, the Toyota tire fire continues to burn as ransomware hit Bridgestone Americas. So Bridgestone, who makes tires, is Toyota's U.S. supplier. And Bridgestone did acknowledge on Friday that they, too, had been hit with ransomware back in February, which forced the shutdown of computer networks and their production at multiple factories in North America. And it said Middle America, which I took to mean maybe Central America, or maybe it means Kansas. I don't know, but it said Middle America, so I don't really know what that meant. But anyway, but they were shut down for almost a week, according to the Reuters article. Bridgestone said that the break-in occurred on 27 of February, which was about 2 weeks after Denso, which was the main supplier of parts for Toyota, got ransomware in Germany. And there weren't a lot of details about this latest attack, but there have been a bunch of attacks on Toyota, including Toyota's factories in Japan, the Denso attacks, and now Bridgestone as well, all up and down this sort of Toyota supply chain. Lockbit ransomware gang claimed this attack on Bridgestone. So that sort of threw a spanner in the works in the sense that, well, is all this related? Or is it just that these manufacturing companies have just really long time neglected security and somebody posted that out there? And so, you know, everybody's going after them because an easy target. It's hard to say, but a lot of different groups have been involved in these attacks, which included Lockbit, Pandora, and other ransomware groups that are seeming to be involved in this. And I don't know if there's a relationship between all those gangs or what. There's probably a Hollywood movie in there somewhere. I don't know. You know, Bad Night at Toyota, a Hallmark special. Yeah. Perky young attorney goes home to help out after the company's ransomware and dad threatened to lose it. I can write Hallmark movies all day long. Anyway, there's a new BitRat variant out there that appears to be spreading, which targets users with pirated or unactivated versions of Windows 10. Everything old is new again. If you're unfamiliar with BitRat, it's a malware as a service product that you can buy down at your corner dark web bodega for very, very low prices. The current price is $20 US for a lifetime supply of BitRat. I mean, all the BitRat you can eat for only $20. So get on down there while the getting's good. But, you know, it's got what plants crave, electrolytes. But anyway, OnLab found that the malware is being distributed as a Windows 10 Pro license activator on a website called WebHards. And WebHards is a wares site in South Korea. Now, none of this is a new tactic, right? We've seen this before. We've seen this over and over again. But the old ways are the best ways. And I just wanted to throw it out there so that you would be aware of it, because if you do have people or you yourself are using unlicensed copies of these things, well, after a while, you have to do something about that. And if you actually go on the wares site and say, hey, look here, a way to license my Windows officially, yeah, it then you get BitRat installed. And so, yeah, so don't do that. Over 100,000 people have installed an Android app that is a credential stealer. And the app, as of yesterday, the app was still available in the Google Play Store. Now, this app is a cartoonifier. And I know what this is, but I'd never seen this term before. So I really like the term cartoonifier because it could be used to describe a lot of things. But it's a cartoonifier that is named the unfortunate name Crafts Art Cartoon Photo Tools. Say that real fast three times. And maybe in Korean it's better or something, but... You know, I always bet there was like cave people grubbing for, well, I don't know, grubs or something, who probably couldn't even imagine that one day we would need cartoonifier apps. But, you know, this one, as usual, allows you to upload your face or your friend's face or your cat's face or whatever, and it's turned into, well, you know, a cartoon of your face. So Pradio found that this particular app, though, also includes, along with the cartoonification algorithm, which I'm really happy I got to say in my life, but it includes a Trojan called, and this is, I really like this, okay? The Trojan is called Face Stealer, which sounds a hell of a lot cooler than it actually is. I mean, I want Face Stealer. But anyway, basically what Face Stealer does is when you install the app, it immediately throws up a login that is, it looks like a Facebook single sign-on login, and it basically says you need to log into Facebook if you want to use the app to cartoonify yourself. Of course, what really happens is you put your credentials in, the app then uploads your credentials to a command and control server at zutu.info, and then they do whatever they're planning to do with it. Probably hijack your Facebook account, I guess. Or maybe they just cartoonify you. I don't know. But in the end, I do think you maybe should remind your users that any app that they install on their phone that requires this kind of cross-site validation, well, be very, very, very careful, because it's really difficult to discern. We have another story later about these kinds of things, but it's very difficult to discern that single sign-on and whether or not it's valid. And, you know, if you read the reviews of this app, it's amazing that there is anyone on earth desperate enough for a cartoonification to install this thing. I mean, comments like useless, fake, totally fake, worthless, I think it bit me, and now I feel a longing to eat human flesh. I mean, those kind of comments should really kind of put you off the product. I mean, I know it could be a troll, but it really, I looked at the comments on it, and it was pretty bad. But I swear, if I ever get another life and I get the good fortune to be on PSW again for the first time and I get to play Five Questions, I am definitely answering face stealer to the serial killer question. Without a doubt, I'm going to be the face stealing person on there. I used to be the omelet killer, but I'm telling you, face stealer is my new thing. Speaking ill of Google continues on this episode. And apparently, according to this story, Google Messages and Dialer, those are two apps for Google Android as well, have apparently been collecting and sending data not to a command and control server, but to Google without offering any opt-outs. Now, this would be in violation of the European GDPR regulation, which, you know, they've been smart enough to pass that. I wish the rest of us could, but they passed it. And it requires you to be able to opt out from this kind of data collection. A Trinity College of Dublin computer science professor published a paper, which is linked in the article if you want to read it, on this matter and described all the data that's being sent about user communications. And it's kind of scary what it's doing because it's not the usual stuff. The data includes a hash of all the message text, and these hashes are allowing you, and the paper explains this, how to link the sender and the receivers of these messages, which means they can put together the whole exchange. And it also includes other information like call times and durations and things like this, which can also be used to link up the ends of different conversations so you can see who they're talking to and what the other person said. Over a billion Android devices have Google Messages installed currently, and it's uploading your info. So both Messages and Dialer, which is a different app, were indicated to be doing this type of reported data collection. Professor Leith, or Leith, I don't know how you say it, but Professor Leith has been in communications with Google since November, reported this information to them, and Google did confirm that they've been working with him on these issues. But he went on and kind of said he wasn't sure they were actually doing anything about it either. So definitely an article worth checking out if you're an Android user and you use any of those apps, so at least you're aware of what's going on. This next article demonstrates how to do a browser-in-a-browser attack, which is, we've all heard this referred to before as a BitB. And basically, these types of attacks rely on, essentially flaws in the way the browser handles scripting, typically. So ideally, what a BitB attack does is it causes some kind of pop-up to appear that you think is something else. So I make a box pop up that says, please put in your birth date to validate that you're of this age or whatever, because I'm collecting birthday information and so forth. And there's been all sorts of phishing attacks that use them, to get you to dive right in and give up all the good stuff like your username and password. So basically, this one is a single sign-on with Google, or it could be Facebook and Amazon, but the current one they were using the example was Google. And I'm sure you've seen these before because we've all had that pop up and say, please log in, with Google or with Amazon or with any of your other accounts to continue. And I see them all the time. Like you go to a news site and a lot of the news sites pop up and says, please log in with Google. I had one today. It was asking me to pop up with Google. I was like, is that legit or is it a BitB attack? But anyway, we'll just keep telling ourselves that they're not collecting our information. Yeah. But we get used to those pop-ups, and they happen all the time, and Facebook, Google, all this kind of stuff. So according to the article, which was based on a post from a user named Mr. Docs, it is very, very easy to create a simulated browser window which spoofs the legitimate domain, and it means that little padlock on there is closed because the domain, and remember, the padlock just validates whatever domain it's linked to. It doesn't have to actually be Facebook. So it's a bunch of, skullduggery here, but the padlock is closed. And of course, if that's all you look at, you go, okay, it's probably legit. Now they take it further steps. So using JavaScript, it's pretty easy to make a pop-up box, as we all know. And when somebody clicks something, we can make it appear, somewhat legit, but there are, we've been training users for a while now to look at this and hover over the links and all these kind of things. But on this one, even if you hover over the link, it doesn't actually work with the attack because JavaScript can circumvent the security if it's being permitted to do so by the browser, which it may well be. So it's basically a function, and they explain all this in the article. So if you want the grim details, you want to see the source code, basically a function It fires off a pop-up window, which is easy to do, but it has a return value of false. And apparently that false return value causes the href attribute to be ignored when you're hovering over the link. So it means when you hover over it, it still looks like the fake link that's actually there. So you think you're seeing the real link, and it's really not. It's like, you know, if I have a link that says facebook.com, we teach people hover over it, and when it actually links to hackme.ru, you're going, okay, yeah, that's not a good idea. But if it still says facebook.com, you may well click on it. And if that did confuse you anyway, there's a pretty good and simple and complete explanation of the code in the article. I don't know what it's going to take to get us to move beyond username passwords, but I do know that all this credential stuffing and these kinds of attacks are going to start pushing for more movement in that direction. So start those startups up. Three critical severity vulnerabilities were found, which affect all sorts of HP printers. Trend Micro's zero-day initiative reported on three separate, actually there's four, but there were three of them were critical, three separate critical vulnerabilities and one high severity vulnerability, which affects HP printers. The flaws are found in hundreds of models from the LaserJet Pro, PageWide Pro, OfficeJet, Enterprise, Large Format, and DeskJet printer models, which is just about everything they make. So there are links to all the models in the article, so if you want to check your printers out and see if they're on this list. The vulnerabilities include a buffer overflow that can allow remote code execution and two 9.8 severity flaws, which can allow information disclosure, remote code execution, and denial of service attacks on your network. If somebody can get to those. HP has official recommendations on there that say update your firmware. Well, okay, but they give you the versions and so forth, but not all these have firmware updates available yet. There was no update available, for instance, for the LaserJet Pro when I was writing the story. But, you know, honestly, internal threats are bad, but if you've got printers exposed to the interweb, you got big problems already. So be careful. And update. The site did say that those updates were pending on the ones that were missing. So check back, get the updates, and put them in place unless you want to have serious problems. Well, his latest line of clothing is called Sexy Dog, because why should your pet not be as hot as you are? And it consists of erotic and exotic clothing for your pets. From the boardroom to the bedroom, your pets should reflect your own personality and sexuality to the fullest. Please welcome Jason Wood.
Everybody, as always, it is good to be back with you and to enjoy my introductions and hear what I've been up to lately. So, you know, there's always this interesting feeling you get when you see something in the news. Basically, say, or a company is being called out, and it's a company you've done business with. They're being called out by the FTC for just screwing up royally. And not only you can, you know, screwing something up, but trying to hide it as well. And that's kind of what this story was to me. I found this on the Sophos Naked Security blog, and then I pivoted over to a statement written by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, or FTC as I'll refer to them, basically announcing a settlement with Cafe Press for a number of bad decisions about their security and how they responded to a data breach in their environment, and a rather large one at that. Now, if you aren't familiar with Cafe Press, this is one of those sites where you can go and create an account. You can stand up a storefront and put your own logo on it, or sayings, or any kind of graphics, and anything from T-shirts to mugs, bags, what have you. You know, you can just kind of do your own customizations. Makes it easy for a small business, right, to put up some apparel to represent the company. In fact, I recall signing up originally for Cafe Press probably back in 2006 when I bought a Paul.com t-shirt back in the beginning days of the podcast. And, you know, that was my introduction to them. And oddly enough, you know, I met Paul later at DEF CON. Wearing that shirt, he threw my first Hack Naked shirt at me. He told me to get rid of that ugly thing. So it was, you know, you kind of like, okay, I've got a bit of a history with these guys. So what's going on, and why did the FTC get involved? I mean, we cover data breaches all the time, and the FTC rarely makes a statement on it. Something about this got them going and investigating Cafe Press. So I read the statement from the FTC, and the complaint basically is that the Cafe Press had a data breach in February of 2019. Okay, that happens. But they did not act on it, basically, or act on it appropriately as they decided. And even worse was they tried to cover it up from the public. And the cover-up really, I think, is where it was the main trigger for getting the FTC involved in this. Basically, they went to some lengths, it appears, according to the judgment of the FTC, to misrepresent what was going on. Now, this is a statement from the FTC, a quote, rather, from their statement. It says, according to the complaint, a hacker exploited the company's security failures in February 2019, to access millions of email addresses and passwords with weak encryption, millions of unencrypted names, physical address, the security questions, and their answers, so we can reset all the usernames or all the passwords, more than 180,000 unencrypted social security numbers. I assume that's for people who are standing up stores and, you know, for reporting taxes and stuff like that, and tens of thousands of partial payment card numbers and expiration dates. Some of this information was later found for sale on the dark web. Not any particular surprise there. And that's the end of the quote. You know, they basically lay out in their statement what happened is the breach gets to Cafe Press's attention. They patched the vulnerability that they thought was behind this and did very little else beyond that. And it kind of remained this way even after a foreign government reported to Cafe Press, hey, we see you guys have a problem. And they reported this in April of 2019. And it was really at this point that Cafe Press took their first public interaction, which was tell customers, hey, you need to change your password because we changed our password complexity requirements. And that was it. They finally got around to notifying businesses that were impacted by this and the retail customers in September of 2019, because this had hit the news and had been being talked about for about a month, really, before they acknowledged it to themselves. You know, again, the whole issue is just this dragging of feet. Well, it gets even a little bit better in the FTC complaint, saying as they start digging into them and looking at how they're doing things. And apparently they found that if the company decided that a shopkeeper, you know, their storefront had been hacked or something like that, they would close down the account and then immediately charge a $25 fee to close the account itself. That strikes me as a pretty good slap in the face. You know, we're not going to help you out. We're going to shut you down. And oh, by the way, it costs you money for us to come in and click a button saying, turn this thing off. And, you know, there was just a laundry of issues that the Cafe Press had here. This just really kind of made me shake my head. Here's a list from the Naked Security blog. Basically, Cafe Press misrepresented the measures they were taking to protect information, the steps that they would take to follow up to security incidents. FTC said they did not use reasonable data security practices, misrepresented how they would use emails. So, you know, you sign up and say, this is just for authentication and we're going to go ahead and use it in whatever way we feel like. Misrepresented how they adhered to privacy regulations in the EU and in the US. So governments typically don't like that when you lie to them. And finally, they misrepresented how they would honor data deletion requests from customers and resellers. Then you get into the list of technical issues. This is like storing passwords without any kind of salting, password hashes, without any kind of salting. Again, I mentioned keeping the password recovery and questions and answers in clear text. That was breached. So if you've got the email address, we can just go and reset it. They allowed the use of those questions and answers for 6 months after they knew that they had been compromised and that Cafe Press said they had fixed the issue, but they hadn't done anything about it yet, or at least required that to change. Failed to notify users of the breach, failed to follow up on malware incidents, didn't notice that an employee account had been taken over entirely due to a malware incident and for a number of months. Failed to investigate attempts to divert, this one, man, this was a killer. Failed to investigate attempts to divert employee payroll deposits to another bank account until it happened for the, not the second time, the third time. That was when they finally started to respond. Didn't have any way of patching systems consistently. Used stuff that was out of date. There were no patches for it anymore. And had no process for following up with notifications from third parties. So they really just had a lot to say about the practices here. What's the end result of this? Basically, they got hit with a $500,000 fine, which hurts. But then the next bit was they're required to operate under a consent decree with the FTC for the next 20 years. And basically at this point, the FTC gets to tell them what they're going to do and how they do this stuff. And in this, on any failure to do so, each occurrence of that has a penalty of almost $50,000 associated with it. So that can add up. So basically, FTC owns and dictates Cafe Press's and their parent company's security program for the next 20 years or so. So what's the takeaway here? I think we've all worked in places where I can picture somebody working at Cafe Press, you know, who's screaming that, hey, we're not doing this right, and being told to, it's too expensive, we can't do that, whatever it is. You know, the takeaway here, obviously, this is an example of what happens when we don't do the right thing. And even worse, when we lie about it. We try and cover it up. And then this is where things really start blowing up. You know, the whole thing could have potentially been avoided if they had the breach and had a moment of, as a wake-up call, and said, oh crud, we've got to fix some stuff here. This may have cost them more than the $500,000 fine, as they're hiring staff and they're making purchases and changing business procedures. But they wouldn't be operating underneath a federal consent decree either, where it dictates how they're going to do things. So yeah, they basically lost control of at least some portion of their business. They have to now allow somebody else to tell them what to do and how they're going to respond to this. And I think that is certainly going to end up costing them far more, you know, in the long run than it would have taken to okay, we've made a mistake, let's respond to this and get our feet underneath this. Let's put together a good security program and move forward in a way that's reasonable and responsible. You know, this is one of those articles, I think, is, you know, as you're at your organization, you're looking for ways to support things that need to change that you see that are problematic, particularly if you, on a policy side where we're just kind of ignoring the need to address security or other things. This is something that you could pop up and say, hey, look at this. This is some of the stuff that can happen if we blatantly disregard, you know, privacy requirements, procedures around this. We have to be ready to respond to this in a way, to some kind of intrusion or breach, in a way that notifies customers, is, you know, basically responsible in how we communicate with people. Don't just tell people, oh, we've changed our password policy, you need to change your password, when really you're hiding the fact that, you know, millions of accounts have been compromised. So this is something that could be useful, again, as a, you know, I don't like to go for the fear idea of motivating people, but at the same time, you know, we have to explain what the risks are. What could happen to us if we continue on down this path? And this is just one of those stories out there that I think that for extreme cases could be potentially useful to highlight some of the costs associated with just ignoring security and requirements and privacy requirements as a whole. So if you want to go take a look at this, there's a lot to read inside the FTC complaint. You can go check out the show notes. It takes you to the Naked Security blog, and then you can pivot over to the FTC statement.
Thank you, Jason. Well, a fine is a fine, right? But when you have to work under the supervision of the FTC, that is a punishment. I mean, that's like, you know, you get a speeding ticket and you go, I'll just pay the ticket and I go back to speeding. But if they tell you, you got to pay the speeding ticket, and for the next 20 years, a police officer is going to ride with you in the car all the time, that is punishment. But I will say, my years as an auditor, I took away one important cynical fact. Everybody lies. Because when we would go in and go, you guys do this, right? They'd be, oh, of course we do. And then you say, show me. And then when you go to see it, they're like, oh, yeah, well, we don't actually do that. We just thought maybe you wouldn't look. So, yeah. Thank you, Jason. And finally, these fears aren't in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders yet, but they may soon be. There's five of them that they listed in this article. Nomophobia is the ominous feeling that you, when you have no bars on your phone. And I've definitely had that. I've definitely been going, oh, my phone's unconnected. I don't know where my hotel is. Yeah, that's one. Scopophobia is the excessive fear of having your OSINT seen up to the point where you, like, you know, basically wrap your whole life in tinfoil. Yeah. I mean, I've had that. You know, you're like, is that camera watching me? I don't know. Is it a real camera? I think it's looking at my passport photo. I'm not sure. How about radiophobia? This is the fear of radiation. It's an old one, actually, but there's a new version of it, which is the fear of 5G and 6G radiation being beamed into your head, which, I mean, we are being bombarded. I call this tinfoil hat a phobia, but, you know, I mean, I personally love bathing in the soothing rays of radiation. I mean, it gives you that ebullient feeling. Amaxophobia and aviophobia are also old fears of driving and flying, respectively, but they've been updated because the new fear is about autonomous driving and autonomous flying. You know, the computers are controlling it. Me, I love our new AI overlords, so just take that down. Phobiaphobia, which is the fear of developing even more phobias than the phobias you already have. I mean, you know, I don't have that, no, because I don't really have any phobias. And you know, I do have the fear of running out of cognac and cigars. I don't know what they call that one. I think it's called a Paul's Security Weekly Phobia or something like that. But anyway, that's the news. Thanks, Jason. I'll see you Friday on the wrap-up show at 11 a.m.